Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Web Sleuth Radio. My name is Tricia Griffith, and fair warning tonight, the dog sitters that were supposed to be here are not here, meaning I have three dogs that at any moment will go into absolute hysterics if they hear a car door shut about 5 miles away. So be prepared. It could happen at any time. Oh, tonight is going to be an incredibly, hopefully, fact-filled show, because we're going to try and get into that mind of the spree killer, Stephen Paddock. But first, I have some bad news to report, and this makes me sick. Newton County Sheriff's Office said they found the body of 15-year-old Kalia McNabb. She was reported missing when she was only 9 days old, and they just found her. They found her body under a log wrapped in cloth. They're trying to find her father. He is the main suspect in this case. He has vanished, and there was previously a warrant out for his arrest for a parole violation. So, obviously, not a great parent here. We'll keep our fingers crossed they catch this monster. And, oh, it just breaks my heart when these little babies, it's so unfair. Don't even get me going. Okay, tonight, we welcome two incredible guests. Joining us will be Dr. Glenn Lipson and author Donna Kaufman. And we're going to try and get into the mind of the Las Vegas spree shooter, Stephen Paddock. Now, he killed 58 people, injured over 500 last Sunday. The people were just enjoying a big country music festival, and when Paddock opened fire from the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino from his room. Now, with these spree killers, we have always had some sort of social media. They've gone on there and posted something weird or posted a bizarre picture of themselves. Stephen Paddock, probably because he's older, nothing. There is no electronic trace, and there is no old-fashioned suicide note that we know of either. In this day of electronic footprints, Paddock has none. Everybody that knew him, his brother, girlfriends, everybody said they were shocked to hear of the horror that Paddock was able to create last Sunday. What we do know is we know he gambled, we know he was rich, we know at some point when he was a kid in the neighborhood, one of the neighbors said his mom said Stephen was a bad kid. His father was on the FBI's most wanted list while Stephen was growing up, and we know he had a prostitute the night of the shooting in his room, but the prostitute left before the shooting started. So let's welcome our guests. I'd like to welcome right now Dr. Glenn Lipson. Dr. Lipson is a San Diego-based forensic psychologist. He does amazing work in the legal system. He evaluates criminals, testifies in court for both prosecutors and defense attorneys, and he's an expert in threat assessment. He lectures all over the place. Dr. Lipson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And also joining us is our good friend Donna Kaufman. You know Donna. She is a nationally heralded true crime investigator whose specialty is forensic science and the legal process. And as a reporter, she's covered most major sex crimes and celebrity death cases of our time. She lectures law enforcement and the public as well, and she's co-authored many books with Dr. Cyril Weck, and the one that's out now you should check out on Amazon. It is called Final Exams. Donna, welcome to Web Sleuth Radio.
Thank you, Tricia. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, we're going to start with Dr. Glenn Lipson. Dr. Lipson, let's just get right to the meat and potatoes of this story. Okay, Stephen Paddock, he had numerous weapons, all legal. Everything was legal. Somehow got, 55 weapons up to his room, something like that. And he proceeded to mow down innocent people. We can't find out anything about him unless something is out there that I wasn't able to find before showtime. Based on what you know, Dr. Lipson, what do you say about this guy?
Well, in the area of threat assessment, we try to look for things that help us predict behavior. One of the things that we find in people who sometimes commit crime is a fascination with weapons. A fascination with weapons is something that makes them feel powerful. When they're able to obtain those weapons, it becomes part of their identity. It becomes part of their self-esteem. And with some individuals, having the weapon sort of makes them feel a little bit like Zeus with a thunderbolt, and that is they feel they have the power whenever they want to take a life.
Mm-hmm.
If, if you'd ever hear the, you know, some of the interviews with Ted Bundy, had to deal with the fact of when he picked up people in his cars that matched the prototype of the woman he wanted to kill. He loved playing God and determining whether he was going to just give them a ride or kill them. And you have similar behavior here with Paddock in that he had been at the Lollapalooza on Fremont Avenue where there were people, and there were a number of other occasions where he basically cased and probably felt powerful that if he wanted to, he could wreak havoc. And there's something related to the facts that came together for someone who had this fantasy for a long period of time. And this fantasy made him feel, again, omnipotent and powerful. And also is an expression of the rage that he felt towards the world. So those are some things that we begin to look for.
And that's the question, Dr. Lipson, because this man didn't seem to be a loser. He was rich. He was gambling. Looked like he was having fun. The only little hints we have about this man who brutally gunned down 58 innocent people and injured 500 plus, the only little tidbits we have are his mom said he was a bad kid. I think the brother may have mentioned something about they were both bad kids growing up, not quite sure what that means. But his neighbors have said he was kind of sullen and not very friendly. Oh, well, that sounds like my brother. He's not a serial killer or a spree killer. A lot of people are sullen and not very friendly with their neighbors. So how do we go about even finding anything if he has insulated himself so much so? He's in this cocoon, and he doesn't seem like he's let anybody in. Now, I believe it was his wife that they picked up at the airport, and they have talked to her, and they have said she knew nothing about it. As a professional that actually deals with this and these types of situations, how in the world would you go about trying to find out what Stephen Paddock was all about? Why did he do this? He felt power. He was, you know, angry at the world, but why?
Well, that we know that he was and these are, when we look at factors, these factors, because violence is a low base rate event, 200,000 or so, someone who commits a murder. A lot of people have these factors present, as you said. They could be quiet and, you know, not very social. So that doesn't necessarily mean that someone's going to commit a crime. They could have autism or Asperger's disease diagnosis. That doesn't mean they're going to commit a crime. So we don't jump from that little bit of information that makes someone vulnerable. We look at the combination of factors. You did have he was raised in a family without a father, but a father who's on the most wanted list. And if the father was a sociopath, did he inherit those traits? Were those present? So, you know, we begin to look at those things. We use, you know, some of the best people coming up with facts, as you know, is someone like Donna, who is very good at finding the cracks in what appears on the surface. And you need someone who has that ability to find those bits of information. We have a few of them. We have the Los Angeles Times talked about how badly he treated his girlfriend in the Starbucks in Reno. Which is not uncommon sometimes for men to choose a woman from the Philippines or an Asian woman because they could treat them differently. And you know, we know that was present. In addition, being engaged frequently in litigation, I know he had a lawsuit that he filed relative to a slip and fall, which was on camera.
Oh, that's right.
And he indicated that he sustained a back injury from it. And he never paid $740, which were left in legal bills, but he had paid everything else. We know that pain sometimes is related to someone being angry. That happened in a hotel. I want to see those filings. I want to see how that case was filed, what his claims were. You know, so that, you know, this right now is getting information and assembling a picture of who this individual is. What happens is you talked about the lack of internet profile. What he loved to play was video poker. And video poker, the odds are stacked against you. I don't know the burn rate he had with the money he was going through, how much was left. We do know from the girlfriend that she said that at times in the morning he did not want to get out of bed and woke up as if someone who was in pain or someone who was dealing with things psychologically. So these are the little cracks where we begin to see something going on in terms of who this individual is. And, you know, we have to get more information. And that's something that Donna, again, is particularly good at.
Exactly. And let's go to Donna Kaufman. Donna is a good friend of Web Sleuths and Web Sleuths Radio. I would encourage you to go to Amazon.com, type in final exams, and get the book from Donna Kaufman and Dr. Cheryl Weck. It's absolutely fascinating. Donna, welcome back to Web Sleuths Radio. Okay. You've been sitting there patiently listening. Let it out. What do you think?
Well, most of what we hear about this guy comes from his brother who's blabbing to the media or the family members of the girlfriend, Mary Lou Danley, who are also talking to the media. I think we have to pretty much ignore all of those things until they're confirmed by the police. But I'm looking at his behaviors, which are described by many, many witnesses, and I'm seeing somebody who's not successful at all. And even Steve Wynn, who owns the Mandalay and other hotels, Wynn Hotel Casino, said he's not a big gambler by our standards. What he is a big loser. He lost $100,000 in the week before. He was playing video poker and slots. Now, those are not the games that a real gambler plays. A real gambler, it's not even about the money. It's about looking at your opponent and psyching them out with your bluffing and your putting the odds in your favor. This guy is just doing repetitive action, OCD kind of gambling, where he has his little, you know, cup of quarters or whatever, and he's feeding, you know, pulling the one-armed bandit, repetitive action. There's no thought to it. There's no canniness. There's no odds. There's nothing. And the other thing is, now he may have made a fortune in real estate at some point. He did own an apartment building where he filed 14 lawsuits against tenants. He did lose the slip and fall case in the hotel because the judge threw it out when people came forward and proved, workers came forward and proved that there was no liquid on the ground that he alleges to have tripped on. But what we have seen is him sitting in front of a, where he knew a video camera was, and doing, oh, my poor back, and all these kind of dramatic, I'm in such pain. But the judge did not accept it. You know, maybe he did fall, who knows, but he lost the case and stiffed his attorney, as Glenn said. The other thing that's interesting is three times a week in his home, Mesquite, Nevada, which is 90 miles from Las Vegas, he would go to a senior center, community center, for their lunches, which were $3.50. And you have, you know, a full cafeteria kind of lunch with dessert and everything, and then he would sit by himself and not interact with any of the people. What kind of multimillionaire does that? I mean, you know, this is his way of filling his stomach. So I want to see the financials before I accept that he's some gambling mastermind with a big fat bankroll. We do know that he sent $100,000, wired it to the Philippines where his girlfriend was from. He put her on a cheap flight, which he bragged about 2 weeks before the event. And by the way, cops are now talking about the event. It has a name. It's called 1 October, number 1 October. So he put her on a plane 2 weeks before and then subsequently wired $100,000, said buy a house in the Philippines. She's not even, she's from the Philippines, but she spent most of her life living in Australia where she had two marriages. One ended in the guy's death. and he was a boxer. He left her fairly well off. And then she has she had a second marriage that may still be intact, but they are living separately. She had been with Stephen for almost a year, and she, when she received the wired money, she thought he was breaking up with her. So, again, I don't know what she's telling cops, but you have to take anything she says with a grain of salt. These people who are relatives don't want to admit that they saw a monster in front of their eyes and did nothing about it. You know, he amassed weapons. He was always a gun guy. But in October of last year, he upped his interest in guns, and he spent $50,000 on an assortment of guns, 23 rifles he had, and a handgun he had in the room with him. 12 of them were modified with what we now call bump stocks, which allows a semi-automatic to become automatic, meaning you just pull the trigger and it fires everything in the drum, everything, all the ammo at once. And there were also apparently handwritten numbers on a table there that were traced back to him, and cops think it was him deciding where to, you know, the trajectories of where to hit the most people. I'm sorry, that's crazy. I don't know what that means. But when you're firing an automatic weapon like that, you're not a sharpshooter. You're not saying, oh, well, look at that girl in the cowboy hat. I'm going to take her. You're just firing randomly. And
You're spraying bullets.
You're spraying, yeah. So there was no great thing about it. Now, there, as Glenn mentioned, too, there were two dry runs before, one in August at Lollapalooza, where he had conned his way into two suites that overlooked the concert, and then he did not show up at the event to use those rooms. And another one a week before, which was a concert in Las Vegas downtown with Lord and Chance the Rapper, and he was at that one. Did he have all his guns with him? Well, we don't know that part yet. You know, was he getting his strength up, his courage up to do this? We do also know that he had been in the desert prior to the shooting, perhaps the day before, because gun ranges do not allow people to bring in semi-autos or autos because of the risk of spraying people with a gun that's out of control. So
exactly. Okay. Donna, can I back up a little bit? Because I don't quite understand one thing that you said. The police have named this tragic event number one October. Does that just mean it's the first big event, the first big tragedy of October?
No, that's the date it happened. It's one week ago tonight.
Well, that's right.
Is when it happened.
That's right. Number one October.
Now, he was seen with the prostitute on the 27th, and his room apparently was rented on that day. On that day as well, there was a room service ticket that showed he had bought a hamburger, a bagel, soup, and two Pepsis. And that was all on the 27th, and it said on there that there were two guests in the room. I'm sure they're looking for that prostitute. There's another prostitute, or perhaps the same one, who has now sold her story and is coming forward. I think we're going to be seeing a lot of that, and you have to take that with a grain of salt. You know what I mean? These are ladies who you know, are not exactly reliable. But anyway,
can I just go ahead? I was just going to jump to Dr. Lipson for a moment, and we'll get right back to you, Donna, because I have a million questions for you. Dr. Lipson, first of all, we're speaking with Dr. Glenn Lipson and author Donna Kaufman. We're talking about Stephen Paddock and the horrible event that happened a week ago tonight, the mass shooting in Las Vegas. We're trying to get into Stephen Paddock's head because this is really the first time that we haven't been able to find a lot about a spree shooter. Just very, very few little tidbits here. And Dr. Lipson, this is this. You know this. You know you do the threat assessments. You work with the criminal minds. I'm going to tell you what one of the officers described when he first walked into the shooter's room, and maybe that'll give you a little bit more of something to go on. An officer said, his name was Dave Newton. He said, "So many guns, so many magazines, stacks and stacks of magazines." And we're not talking about the kind you read. We're talking about the ones with bullets. Just in suitcases, all neatly stacked. These magazines were all neatly stacked against pillars around the room, all stacked up, rifles placed all throughout, all kinds of monitors and electrical equipment. He had it all in there. It just looked almost like a gun store. Does that, obviously that can help you kind of decide where his mind was at some point, right?
Well, you know, his background was accounting, that he definitely had what we would call obsessive traits. He's in terms of how you stack and you place things. And it also goes to the degree of planning that was taking place. Typically, when we talk about mental illness, the court does not allow someone claiming to be a psychopath as a mental illness that forgives or excuses behavior. They look at more emotional or affective or other disorders. But what you're seeing is something which is more akin to someone who's a sociopath, in that without regard, he sprays and takes the lives of so many people and injures so many others. And you have that level of planning in terms of the cameras, where guns are placed. And that, of course, is part of that sense of fantasy and power, that he'll be able to hold off the world. And that also fits in with some other factors that Donna's going to talk to you about a little later in terms of what was in his car. But, I mean, this is someone who had obtained a lot of ordnance, and in addition to have, you know, had the weapons which were lined out in this manner. The other thing that we sometimes find in people who are antisocial is an attraction to gambling, because it's stimulating if you win, it's stimulating if you lose, and that sort of risk-taking is not uncommon in people who have those type of sociopathic traits.
Dr. Lipson, I want to go off the beaten path here for just a moment and talk to you about psychopath as compared to a mental illness. You talk about the courts do not recognize somebody who says they're a psychopath and are able to use that as an excuse. The courts won't allow it. But realistically, a psychopath can't be helped by drugs. There's some theory that maybe they could be helped by talk therapy, and then there's the other theory that talk therapy just helps them become a better psychopath. How come the courts don't allow that? If somebody is a psychopath and they've committed a crime, I would think they would be able to use that maybe as a defense, although I'd hate to think of them getting out back on the street because they're a psychopath. Am I up in the night here with what I'm talking about?
Well, there isn't a direct fit between a mental illness and a criminal defense. A criminal defense is based on whether or not you appreciate the nature and quality of your action. Obviously, someone who obtains these weapons and does calculations on a sheet to figure distance and where you're going to have the most effect with when you shoot is someone who is really cognizant of their behavior and appreciates what he did is wrong. So what demonstrates he appreciates what he did is wrong? Having cameras to basically prolong this event as long as possible to see when people are coming, to kill as many first responders that may be coming towards the room in terms of how he had that set up. So all these things suggest he knew the nature and quality of his actions. And the only time mental illness bears on that is in what we call the insanity defense. And that's basically what we call a wild beast defense. And that is, by virtue of mental illness, you don't appreciate the damage you're causing or that what you're doing is wrong. And that's the only way mental illness then figures into a criminal defense. So part of it is what goes on with the law. In addition, our diagnoses of sociopathy are often based on behavior. So what you say is, hey, you've been committing crimes and harming people for a long period of time, so hence you're a psychopath. And then why would that then be a reason not to hold you accountable? So they tend to be circular diagnoses where a lot of people would qualify for that who are in prisons. We could discuss the issue of treatment, but I just want to give you that perspective in terms of the court.
He did a workup on a mass shooter case of some renown.
So
yeah,
can you talk
about
that, Dr. Lipson?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think I brought it up before when we've been on together your show, but my doctoral dissertation was on the San Ysidro massacre, where we had 21 killed by James Huberdick.
Oh, that's right. Okay. You did an amazing. That was amazing. Please continue.
Yeah, so we basically looked at what was going on with James Huberty, and I focused in particular, and he basically said that day, I'm going to go out hunting humans. And his wife did nothing, and he went down to the local McDonald's, and then the shooting started. And that is one of the major events in the United States where we began changing law enforcement for shooter responses. And the reason Well, the SWAT teams used to have to get their weapons, which could be long rifles and other types of things you don't have in patrol units. They'd have to go to the Central Division to get those weapons. And so what that meant was you'd have someone secure the perimeter while you waited for the SWAT team to come armed with body armor and the like. Well, that prolongs the amount of time someone in those environments could kill. James Huberty was killed by a single shot of a sniper, and you had people hiding in the McDonald's, so fortunately he didn't make it from them, but there was delay, and the issue was to secure the perimeter. In addition, there were a couple young boys who were shot and bleeding to death at the planter box in front of the McDonald's, and they couldn't get them. So afterwards they bought an armored car that had a hatch where you could actually pull over a victim and then lift them up. So what's happened now with first shooter protocol is, number one, the first responders are always the people who are on the scene. And so law enforcement knows that the people who are responding were the people who were down at the concert. Because it takes 5 or 6 minutes sometimes for everyone to get there and respond to the situation. So now the protocol is to go towards the shooter to stop the event from happening. Why that's happening, if you're in law enforcement, you don't pay attention to the people who've been injured because more people may be getting killed. So you actually step over people who are shot, maybe screaming, maybe in pain, because you're trying to prevent that person from coming back, finishing the job, or harming other people. So that's part of the first shooter protocol you have now, which is you do what you're trained when you're in law enforcement, which is counterintuitive. You move towards the field of fire. And that's what ended up happening. So those are some significant changes that have happened in terms of how we respond to these situations now.
And when did the McDonald's shooting take place? Was it 82, did you say?
It was 84. So,
84. I remember that.
Yeah, and it was during the Democratic Convention. And so the fact that was taking place in San Francisco resulted in a different amount of press coverage. I mean, one of the things I found was almost everyone had been traumatized who covered it, including the reporters.
That's interesting.
Yeah, these are very difficult images to leave. And one of the findings from the dissertation was that the familiarity you have with an environment, like most people who've been in a McDonald's, makes it much more difficult to recover because you could have imagined yourself being there. So it's more real for you when something like that happens.
Interesting. I never thought about the reporters on the scene. I thought of the first responders, of course, but you're right. It could be very traumatizing to a reporter who's obviously never been in any situation like that. Maybe he's never even seen a dead body. So that's certainly understandable. Let me pause and tell everybody the wonderful people that we have on our show today. We're talking with Dr. Glenn Lipson. Dr. Lipson is an expert in evaluating criminals, also in threat assessment, and we have Donna Kaufman. Donna is a good friend of Web Sleuths and Web Sleuths Radio. Her latest book with Dr. Cyril Weck is called Final Exams, and it's available on Amazon. And Donna, Dr. Lipsom made mention of what was found in Paddock's car. Why don't you tell us about that?
His car was parked in the parking lot of Mandalay Bay. It had inside 50 pounds of explosives, ammonium nitrate, which when blended with fuel can provide an explosive that you could see from the Hubble telescope. That is what Tim McVeigh used to take down the Murrow building in Oklahoma City. What he was planning to do with that, we don't know. The cops have said that they thought there was a part two that he never got to because when the walls were closing in on him, meaning Paddock, he shot himself with a handgun. There's a real important part of this that may or may not go to his state of mind. When he was firing at the crowd at the concert, he brought a hammer, he broke out the northeast window, and that's what he set up his tripod and his rifle to take out the concert goers. He also broke the east window and fired from there, and he had a similar kind of tripod and rifle set up there. And that was aimed at two fuel tanks just outside McCarran International Airport in a parking lot that was known as the Janet parking lot. And you hear people in Las Vegas talk about this, but they're leaving out the part that I'm going to tell you now. Janet Airlines is an acronym jokingly called Just Another Non-Existent Terminal. Don't look here. We're hiding in plain sight. Nothing to see here, folks. What it is the CIA's transport. It's a private airline, and I've seen the planes take off. I listen to their ATC transmission sometimes, and they're white planes, 737s and other kinds of planes in the fleet, and they're completely white with a red stripe. You don't see a logo, you don't see lettering, you don't see the N with numbers after it. It's just completely undercover in plain sight. And they use McCarran's airline, they use their flight paths, and that's what they share the takeoff and landing spots with McCarran. But it is a private shuttle transport for military and intelligence workers who park right there in that by those two fuel tanks, giant fuel tanks, round, huge fuel tanks, which you can see if you go to Google Earth. And they go every day with a private security clearance pilots, air traffic control, flight attendants, and the personnel who are on there are going to either Area 51 or other places where top secret government work occurs. One of the places they're going every day is 35 miles northwest of McCarran to Creech Air Force Base, C-R-E-E-C-H, and that is where the joint United States and United Kingdom drone force operates, where you have people looking at screens all day, identifying targets in the Middle East, mostly Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and saying, hey, there's that guy we've been looking for. He's in that car, and you can absolutely zero in and see what the car license plate is. And when they find an enemy that is on the list for elimination, somebody in the room gives the nod, and a button is pushed, and 9,000 miles away, or however far it is, a Hellfire missile is released and takes out that target. And what happens on the ground, somebody is in a car, all of a sudden it blows up, and the bystanders go, oh, my God, what's going on? And they rush mm-hmm. over, and policy demands that a second drone attack occurs. Another Hellfire missile comes down 2 minutes later, and that takes all the bystanders who are trying to help. So there's great collateral damage in these very contentious, controversial drone firings. Now, did he know that that's what he was trying to blow up when he was...
That's
he connected bullets twice with the fuel tanks, but they did not burst the skin of the fuel tanks because there's inside the fuel tanks there's a another lining that his bullets, even though they were high-powered, did not go through. We don't
mm-hmm.
know. Was he? He was somebody who worked for the precursor of Lockheed Martin at some point in his life. So did he have
mm-hmm.
ongoing angst toward American policies, especially toward enemy nations, especially those trying to take out ISIS? ISIS, of course, he had ties to the Philippines, where ISIS is very much a place of planning. Or what,
mm-hmm.
did he just want to see a pretty explosive go up? We don't know that, and I'm dying to find out. I can't wait to find out what level of consciousness he had about that. But that was a separate firing that he was doing and with purpose. Now, if he had escaped and gotten out of that hotel and got in his car, he could have done two things. He could have set off the car downstairs and blown all those explosives. 50 pounds of explosives could have been detonated with a handgun or with a rifle fire, and that could
mm-hmm.
have taken down the entire hotel. But he also could have driven his car right to those fuel tanks, which were like 1,100 feet away, and set up an explosive situation where those fuel tanks would have certainly gone up in flames
mm-hmm.
and in an explosion and taken out everything that was in the area of that parking lot, which is the Janet parking lot. So I don't know. I want to know.
You know, Donna, there are going to be so many theories and conspiracy theories, and they're going to go wildly all over the place about Stephen Paddock. But what you just told us was absolutely fascinating. I've never heard of Janet, and damn woman, how did you find this out? Is this public information?
I'm a geek. I actually listen to transmissions from air traffic control, you know, when I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, what can I say? Some people like music. I like planes. I love aviation and flying and stuff. So I knew about Janet.
Well,
and the first time you see, I was at McCarran watching planes take off, and I saw a Janet take off. And I went, what
mm-hmm.
is that plane that has no identification on it except a white, it's white with a red stripe? What is that plane? And so I
mm-hmm.
researched and found it out, and like I say, hiding in plain sight. They have to take off
right
and
there.
Land somewhere.
That's true. Absolutely. And who would have... Nobody gives any thought about that until now. Now our listeners will know about Janet.
Oh, let me mention something else that Glenn and I were talking about this earlier, and he can jump in on this as well. There's a parallel to Charles Whitman, which was the first mass shooter in 1966. He was a 25-year-old ex-Marine,
right.
gambler, loser, who was on Valium as Paddock was in a therapeutic sense. And I say Paddock's toxicology has not been released, so we may see all sorts of other things on that front.
Mm-hmm.
But with Charles Whitman, he was just a ne'er-do-well. He stabbed to death his mother and his wife and then went to the University of Texas in Austin, climbed a tower, and just used his rifle fire for 96 minutes killing a wide variety of people before he was finally killed. I think there were 17 mm-hmm. deaths and from gunfire and 31 people wounded. Now, one of the things he asked, because he had been complaining about horrible headaches and no doctors were giving him the right kind of medicine that could help, and he asked that there be an autopsy because he thought something was wrong. And when they autopsied him, they found he had a pecan-sized brain tumor at a particular
right.
part in the back of the brain. And the medical examiner said, yeah, but that didn't have any bearing on this at all. And then some defense sympathizers got a hold of Governor Connolly, who was governor at the time, and all of a sudden they wrote a report that said, yeah, it had a great deal to do with whether he was mentally ill or, you know, mentally, physically ill or just a ne'er-do-well, mm-hmm. angry man. He was also on Dexedrine, which was self-prescribed and, you know, I think was probably a bigger factor than any kind of small brain tumor. But, you know, that remains an open issue whether that had a – so as soon as Paddock did this and his brother started spouting off, his brother said, yeah, you got to check him for a brain tumor. So I'm sure somebody mm-hmm. told him about Charles Whitman, and I'm sure
right.
the medical examiner who did the evaluation that we don't know yet what's in the autopsy on Paddock certainly was looking for any physical kind of issue.
Yeah, abnormalities. I have a question. Actually, can we go to my producer, Bessie? Bessie has a question. She is the one that does all the heavy lifting and all the work. Bessie, join us, please. You had a question for Donna?
Oh, hey, yeah, I'm here. No, I just wanted, I missed, how far away was Janet and those fuel tanks from the hotel?
1,100 feet. So very close. Remember,
oh, okay.
the guns that he had could take out a target 2 miles away.
Right.
So we're talking not far at all.
Feet, and I said, no, I must have heard that wrong. So it was that close. That's
that
amazing.
Close.
That is really something to think about.
Well,
thanks.
Yeah.
Thank God
and
they
it was
that.
A little farther than the concert. You know, the concert, I don't know, 900 feet or from where
well,
he was. What I don't know is how many rounds he fired from the gun that was pointed at the fuel tanks. I do know that he hit them twice, and as soon as, you know, the dust cleared, they had people out there repairing the tanks, painting over it. Nothing happened here, folks. You know, go look at the concert. Look at the concert. Don't look here.
Oh, so he did hit the fuel tanks twice.
Yes.
Okay, I thought you said that too.
But they didn't breach
sure.
the skin. They didn't breach
right.
the skin because there's a inside, I don't know if it's made of lead or what, I have no idea, but there's some kind
yeah.
of protective inner lining that
yeah.
wasn't breachable. But if he had his car right there and set his car as an
mm-hmm.
explosive device with the 50 pounds of, you know, fertilizer and explosives in that car, then I don't think it would have been protected.
Right.
Wow.
Donna?
That adds a whole new dimension.
It does. Donna, I know I promised you that I would let you go at about 45 minutes in, but can I beg you just to stay for just a few minutes longer?
Oh, sure.
Okay, Dr. Lipson, is that okay?
Yeah,
can you stay
definitely.
A few minutes longer? Okay,
yeah,
great.
Definitely.
Bessie, was that everything? I think she's gone now. She's evaporated. Okay, let me go to Dr. Lipson.
I'm sorry, I was muted. That was it for right now. Thanks
okay,
again
thanks,
for
Bessie.
The answers.
Let's go to Dr. Glenn Lipson. And Dr. Lipson, could it simply be that Stephen Paddock was angry, and this anger festered in him because he did a slip and fall that was obviously fake, the judge didn't buy his story, and he was humiliated by this. Could it have been something that ridiculous that could have set off this fire in this man. And let me add an addendum to that. There had to be something wrong with him anyway to let anything bother him so much that he had to do this. But could it be something like not long term, not something festering for years and years, just this one incident? Could that be enough to trigger somebody like Stephen Paddock?
No, you're looking at personality and a long-term failure to really connect with people, along the lines. I mean, this is someone who, as you heard from Donna a few moments ago, he joins a retirement community. People join a retirement community for the word community. They're getting together with people. And they, whatever they're doing in the evenings, there's activities or get-togethers. He was not friendly. No one ever saw him. There wasn't that level of connection that you would look for. It's a combination and intersection of a number of different factors, and we'll have to find those out as we move ahead. Anger is one of them. Anger is often seen in people who are very narcissistic. They have bouts of rage. One of the things, if we look at the kindling, is the night before the shooting, he complained twice about the noise that was being made in the room directly below him. And he was complaining about how much the noise was bothering him. So one of the things I'd be interested in was how much was the noise from the concert there on the 32nd floor?
Gotcha.
How much did he hear? And, you know, it's the 64-year-old man who's angry at the noise that was made downstairs. Was this even greater noise in terms of what was intruding into his space? There's a lot going on here, but this is not the sort of anger that you see red and you strike out. This was planned. It's planned when sit and you contemplate wind factors. Where's the best place to shoot? What are the best targets to obtain? How are you going to do maximal amount of damage? We are living in a world today where there is competition among individuals who commit crimes like this to have the highest death toll. So what happens is each of these events set the bar that people want to have more press and go higher and higher. So what was set at the nightclub, at the Pulse nightclub, then you want to exceed, and then there'll be someone down the road who will basically say, I have to do much better than 58. And this is how this escalates. And what they do is, and we'll find this out from the computers, they often will go and they will study other people who've committed crimes like this. I have evaluated children who one of them killed his mother, and there were guns in the car, and he was on his way to do a school shooting. And he had just stabbed his mother to death and then took the car with him. So there are, you know, there's the sense of, it's better to burn out than fade away, but there's the sense of what's your legacy in history. That is part of the narcissism that we see in some of these sociopaths, that whatever they do, they want to do it bigger and larger so people are talking about them. I mean, the Son of Sam loved to listen to his coverage, you know, and sit in bars and hear about him and the terror that was taking place. So there is that fantasy that exists.
Well, that's what confuses me, is that why do these guys then commit suicide when the cops are breaching them? Why don't they just go to trial and then they know how many people they died? You know, he died without knowing that he is now in the record books as America's, you know, top maniac shooter, which seems inconsistent.
It's the cowardice. It's the cowardice that they're not only, you know, it's when the bully's confronted. It's the cowardice that exists. So they're terrified for being seen through or being analyzed. At that moment, it's the height of their life that they know they're doing this, and that seems like the best moment to go out. And that's part of what fuels it. I mean, he may have had fantasies of getting away.
Yeah.
But you know, that at that moment, I mean, there's that terror. And, you know, that's one of, you know, in some ways, that's the final exclamation, that this is going to remain a mystery. by the fact that
Breivik, who is the Norwegian mass killer who shot people and blew others up, he lives in isolation in Norway and has a 21-year sentence. Why he is not given life in prison is beyond me, but he lives very well. He's got internet access. He's got, you know, video games he's allowed to play. He lives extremely well, especially for somebody who's a loner. So could American prisons have handled Paddock with safety, isolated from other prisoners so he wouldn't get killed by somebody else? Maybe that was a factor to why he killed himself, because he feared, you know, justice on the inside.
Prison.
Yeah, well, Norway doesn't really have the death penalty. We have isolation cells, especially if it's a federal crime that had been built. It's a little different in the state. Like, we know what happened to Dahmer. I mean, he was killed. While working as a janitor. So there.
Yeah, Dahmer was in isolation and then said, I can't stand being isolated anymore. Put me in Gen Pop. And as soon as he was in Gen Pop, he was killed by another inmate, a lifer with nothing to lose.
That's right. And you and I have talked about that. You know, in some ways, then you have the inmate taking on the persona and the reputation that they're the one who killed the worst of the worst.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, big man on campus now.
No, they're the big man on campus, so that they score a lot of points that way. But I mean, in that particular moment, you want to appear brave and dangerous. To look pathetic afterwards isn't necessarily how they're telling this story. So, mm-hmm. You know, part of it is the thought that they're going to go out in terms of what takes place. In terms of the crime, I mean, we would have had more at Columbine if the tanks had detonated, the propane tanks.
It would have been awful.
Yeah.
Right, they set up the bombs under the tanks, right, at Columbine, and they didn't go off?
Yes.
It's terrible. Dr. Lipson, I'm sorry, Donna, were you finished? I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I'm intrigued. But, well, one thing is that they are, a lot of people have said they thought that Paddock was not a millionaire, but homeless, because he was so unkempt and stinky and always wearing, you know, dirty flip-flops with dirty feet. And, you know, he was just unkempt. So he didn't have any kind of personal grooming interest. And, you know, that was odd. The people at the senior center where he had his lunches up to three times a week said, we really thought he was a homeless guy from the neighborhood. We had no idea he had, you know, money and a house nearby, and, you know, we had no idea.
And he frequently reeked of alcohol. So there, you know, there's potentially some of that liquid courage there also in terms of how that fits in.
And
so
his brother was a meth head, so perhaps, you know, there were other licit or illicit drugs that will be found on the toxicology. You know, there could have been all sorts of let's get our courage up factors.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lipson, I have a two-part question here, okay? First is to do with the young child that you told us about. I don't know how young he was, but he was getting ready to do a school shooting, and he ended up stabbing his mother, and he had guns in the car going to school. Somebody like that, how do you know, your specialty is threat assessment, how do you know when a child, and I mean like a teenager, you know, 12-year-old, whatever, how do you know when a child is going to break like that? And then when you're done, I'll have the second part of my question.
Okay, so to answer that, we tend to avoid what Park Dietz points out, which are fingers snap, not people. It is very mm-hmm. seldom a breaking. It's a planning. It's a buildup. It's the acquiring of weapons, the thinking of targets, the rehearsal. all those elements. So one of the things you look at, and this is what I got in the interviews with this 16-year-old, was that he was going to web pages to study mass murderers to learn how to do it better. And in some mm-hmm. ways, his identification with these antisocial, angry individuals made him feel more powerful. And he was going to learn, and he wanted to be in that gallery of rogues who had harmed so many people. And it isn't uncommon, and we found it in Newtown, it isn't uncommon for some of these people who go to commit these crimes to first kill their parents, in particular the mother, if they're being raised by the mother.
Interesting.
So it's, and Don could also speak to this, but it's not, you usually find often a series of events that happen on the way to committing a mass shooting.
Adam Lanza's mother bought him the guns that he used to first kill her before he went to take out all the children and teachers in Connecticut.
Yes, and my understanding of that was that one of the things that happens is I believe that the mother only was able to get a smile out of him or get control, a sense of control out of him, if she and she bought that gun for him as a present. And that this was a present that she knew would make him happy, not realizing mm-hmm. at the time that she was giving a weapon to someone who was involved in first shooter games on his computer with the windows blacked in. And some of the shooter games involved killing people in schools. And so he did all that desensitization, and then the mother gave him a rifle.
Very scary. Dr. Lifson, I have my second part of the question. We're talking about a child now, and you... and I say child, even though they're teenagers. Let's talk about Stephen Paddock specifically. What in the world could anybody have done? He purchased everything legally. He wasn't doing anything wrong other than going up and confessing, I'm going to kill a bunch of people. Other than that, what could the people around him be looking for and maybe the red flags that he may have shown? And hopefully people listening, they will take note and just keep it in mind and watch their relatives and friends to make sure that nobody is at this point in their lives. What could people have done about Stephen Paddock that knew him?
Well, first of all, I mean, part of it is, did people really know him? How much was the false self? I mean, Don and I have talked about this, and that is, were people ignoring some of the signs? Were they just, and people tend to do it, oh, he's just weird, oh, he just loves guns, he's had an interest in guns for a long period of time. So people tend to discount the information because they don't believe it's anyone they know doing something like this. So mm-hmm. that, what people know is you have to rely on your intuition, your sense that something's off here, and potentially, you know, at some time talk to law enforcement. After the killings that took place in Mumbai, where all of that was set up in the hotel, there was changes in hotels in Europe in terms of if the do not disturb sign was on the door, mm-hmm. do not necessarily go in. You know, you have to check it after a couple of days. After Mumbai, I got together with James Turner, who recently died. He was one of the founders of Blue Delta Force. And that basically dealt with intelligence and counterintelligence in terms of trying to prevent these things. So we had come up with a program to train hotel employees what to look for at the particular time of Mumbai. If you see someone with a lot of cell phone purchases, cell phones could be used as IED triggers. If you find people who bought a lot of Casio watches, they could be used as bomb triggers. So what we have to do is we have to increase how much we pay attention. In addition, what we saw in Aurora, that one of the signs is the acquisition of a tremendous amount of ammunition. And when mm-hmm. you obtain so many thousands of rounds of ammunition and so many pounds of that tracer material that's also very explosive, these are signs that something potentially is brewing. And we have to do a better tracking of someone who's buying thousands of rounds of the type of ammunition that potentially could be used in the conversion of a semi-automatic to an automatic weapon. And, you know, those are some of the things that need to be done.
So there's no law that says I can't go into Cabela's and buy out all of their bullets, right? There's nothing that will stop me from buying as much ammunition as I want. Is that right?
Correct. And a lot of people are ordering them online, like the bump
right.
stocks. I mean, you could order them and just have them delivered. And
mm-hmm.
and that was one of the signs of before the Aurora shooting was the obtaining of all those materials that even someone who's avid at target practice would never want to obtain
mm-hmm.
that many explosives.
Right. Oh, that's just
May
awful.
I just say that we need to start prosecuting relatives, girlfriends, and people who had to have known. How did
yes.
these people lived in a two-bedroom house. Even if he had a closet filled with $50,000 worth of guns and or plus, the nature of that kind of gun ownership means bringing them out, cleaning them, dealing with them like they're, you know, precious cargo. And
mm-hmm.
where are you going to do that? On the dining room table? She walked in and saw all these modified guns and didn't think to call authorities when she got to the Philippines. She waited for something to happen. I'm sorry, it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable for Klebold and Harris's parents to have seen, oh, don't go into my son's room because it's full of explosives and guns. He's 15
right.
years old. He shouldn't have that stuff. Shame on you people. You know, don't write books afterward and say, oh, we didn't know. Yes, you did. And the Orlando shooter's wife went on
mm-hmm.
shopping sprees with her husband to buy guns. He had told her he plans to shoot the people at that particular club because he was anti-gay, and she did nothing about it. Now, she has been brought back to Florida, and she said she was afraid of him and feared for her child, their child.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe that's so. So then give her a reduced sentence, but prosecute her.
Right.
And she is being prosecuted, and she deserves to be. You gotta do that. And one other thing, I know you're running out of time, I want to say, is when you go to a concert, please be aware. Any kind of venue, indoor, outdoor, wherever. And now they're going to have snipers on other buildings, and they should have had that because that could have taken out this guy easily. But
mm-hmm.
You know where the exits are, know where the places that seem like if you're in a disaster, have a plan, know where to escape to.
Mm-hmm.
Avoid running toward a fence that's not going to give. I mean, you know, I understand you're not thinking clearly, so think clearly before the concert starts. You know, do your
mm-hmm.
own dry run of the venue and know where you would run to if you have to. I'm sorry we have to think that way, but, if
it's
saves
sad.
A life, it's worth it.
That's called situational awareness, and we do have to point out that in crowd behavior, that when a crowd starts working, it's moving. Sometimes it's like a tidal wave, and you can't move
mm-hmm.
any other way. You get swept up in it.
Right.
It's a very, very difficult situation for someone present in those situations. I know, having evaluated serial killers and people who've committed all types of murders, that the way I am in the world is changed in terms of I will never sit with my back to a door in a restaurant. I always look. Yeah, no, every place I go into, I scope out where the exits are, where I could sit, and a number of places, because when you've testified for the prosecution, there may be people who aren't very happy with you.
I can imagine you have a few enemies here and there.
Yeah, you end up with those types of things. And the same thing when you're a crime writer. There are people who are not going to be happy with you when you mm-hmm. speak the truth like Donna does. So
yeah, I never sit with my back to, you know, I always sit with my back to the wall, so I'm aware of who's coming toward me. And I learned that because I all the poker players of the Old West used to do that too. They had Wyatt Earp
really?
And, you know, Doc Holliday, all those guys were completely afraid of somebody sneaking up behind them and blowing their heads off. So, you know, they would play in a long, instead of at a round table, they would, you know, mm-hmm. have to make adjustments. There was a scramble for seats against the wall because they, you know, anyway. But, yeah, you have to be savvy.
You do in this day and age. And like you said, it is very, very sad. When I just think back to my childhood, nothing was remotely like this. And we even had a shooting in our neighborhood. But it didn't make everybody freak out and, you know, practice ducking and all of that. And now I didn't even think about a restaurant, you know. But I'm too boring. Nobody will waste a bullet on me, so I'm lucky that way. I'm just a big, walking, boring person. So I will sit with my
back
to the door.
Well, yeah, but, you know, the people who attended the concert were just normal people, too. They weren't targets
right.
until he made them a target. So, yeah, I'm just saying that anybody could be a target at any point in any place.
Yeah, especially if you're looking for a body count. It doesn't matter whose body it is. You're trying to hit
right.
a higher number than has been ever obtained before. And if that's the motivation to be the worst of the mass murderers, then it doesn't matter who you are. If you're in target, you'll be killed.
That's true. Dr. Glenn Lipsom, does this keep you up at nights wondering, oh, dear, now somebody is going to try and beat this record? What can be done?
Well, it doesn't keep me up at night, in part because I don't think I could do this work or Donna could do this work if it kept us awake at night. I mean, what we end up doing is trying to tell these stories in order to assist others in prevention and learning, so we pick up the things we need to pick up earlier. And in addition, mm-hmm. create a world where people who suspect something might be happening or is going to happen, that they're held responsible if they do not act. And that becomes very important because
exactly.
it never occurs that someone doesn't know something is coming. And we have to make those who know something is coming and do not step forward are responsible if they did not act, and we have to have people aware that this is the world we're living in.
Here's the dilemma, okay? Let's say I'm Mary Jo housewife, and my husband is a grumpy guy, and I notice him stockpiling bullets and buying more guns. I go to the police, and what? Then what? They don't arrest him because he hasn't done anything illegal, and then he's an abuser, and so he beats the hell out of me. I'm not trying to be Debbie Downer here and not say that's a good idea. It is, absolutely. We need to do this and to be aware. But can you see how some people might be frightened to go forward and accuse a boyfriend or a spouse?
Yeah, definitely. Donna was talking about the defense that the wife of the Pulse killer is trying to arrange in terms of she was afraid. But let's look at part of this is legislative. In California, if you're accused of domestic violence, and now this alleged fellow beat the person for going forward, then those mm-hmm. weapons are seized and the bullets are seized.
Okay.
So we and other states may follow California in terms of not allowing people who engage
mm-hmm.
in domestic violence to have guns. And that's the sort of legislation we need, despite the NRA refusing it. On February 15th, Donald Trump signed into law after it was passed that mental illness should not bar a person's ability to get weapons. That's going in the wrong direction.
Don't even tell me that. I can't take that.
You get someone
who's
paranoid and crazy, and now they have Second Amendment rights to buy guns. So,
unbelievable.
You know, based on the signature of the pen. So we really need to work on legislation that the people who are beating people, if they are reported, if there are allegations, that those weapons then are seized. It's one of those things where you have to look at maybe you saved your life, but what did you, how many people did you allow to die by not acting? And
right, well, that's a good point.
You know, I know people who are government snipers, and that job is going to become even more important now that we're going to be putting snipers, you know, in hidden places for crowd control. And to a certain extent that happens. You've got them at major parades. You've got them at Super Bowls and stuff. So we're going to be seeing more of that. Those guys can have all the guns they want because they have a reason for that. They have respect for the guns. They know how to use them, and they know the power of those guns. But if you're married to some guy who is an unemployed doofus with substance abuse problems, and he starts compiling guns of that caliber, of that magnitude, then you have to think, why am I in this marriage? Why am I living with this guy? And even if you have children, get the hell out. And it comes down to some kind of personal responsibility. And I had a heartbreaking story happen last week or a couple weeks ago. A girl was driving home. Her car went into a ditch that was filled with water. And she calls her mother and says, I'm going to be drowning. I just wanted to say I love you. She drowned.
Oh, dear God.
And it was horrible. By the time the mother got there, she told the mother, I'm sorry. You should have called 911. I'm very sorry you're dead, but I'm very sorry you didn't have the the training, the savvy, the understanding of emergency awareness. That you don't call your mother and say goodbye. You first of all, you call 911, tell them where you are, and then also have in your car some kind of hammer or something that you can use to break the window or open the door to get out of a bad situation. You know, I mean, you know, what we do to our own selves sometimes is just appalling to me. Sad. We can't do that.
Well, we definitely need to take care of ourselves more. I'm sorry, Dr. Lipscomb, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was going to say, Donna may know this case. His name's Hudson. He's serving life imprisonment in Arizona. He killed his sergeant. He was a police officer and another police officer in the evidence locker. He was going to the evidence locker to steal cocaine. And he was working undercover trying to, and he never was assigned to bring down what was the Dirty Dozen, which is involved in a lot of meth distribution in the United States. Same issue of even with children in the house, guns started appearing everywhere. He wasn't taking care of himself. He wasn't shaving. He had body odor. He looked unkempt. When you begin to get the accumulation of guns, ammunition, and there's a dramatic change in behavior, like the inability to shower and or the lack of hygiene, these are signs that you need to do something if you're involved in that person's life. And if you have guns, don't allow them to be where a child could get them, especially when someone before had the intelligence to use trigger locks and gun safe before. Now guns are everywhere. Because in his mind, the Dirty Dozen was going to get him. And his use of stimulants occurred because he had to weigh less to be on the SWAT team. And in addition to weighing less to be on the SWAT team, he was in a bar where they wanted to determine he wasn't undercover cop, so they had him snort some stimulant. And after that, he kept using it. And that's why he ended up in the evidence locker. So when we study these cases or I evaluate these people, I see the pattern that you look at it and you say, why the hell didn't anyone recognize this or say something? And one of the signs is guns and ammunition everywhere. It is much more than it is a hobby. Every sniper, everyone who's engaged in SWAT, treat those weapons with the utmost respect. And it isn't the respect when they're lying everywhere and other people potentially can get access to them.
Also, what you just said is when you are somebody who works in substance abuse areas, there's a certain degree, a certain percentage of people who fall victim for that stimulation. They become cocaine addicted or methamphetamine addicted or whatever it is, just as there's a great degree, higher degree of dentists who become addicted to nitrous oxide because it's such a wonderful drug, easily obtained in their offices. And I know of dentists who would hook themselves up after hours and enjoy that pleasant experience and become addicted and later on develop things like multiple sclerosis and things that came out of direct descendant of that addiction. So there's always kind of a scare when you're working around addictive drugs that even though you're not, you're not an addict before, you're supposed to be concerned about them and disseminating them carefully, you can fall victim.
You can fall victim very, very easily. I think it happens a lot more than we think. You have both stayed over 30 minutes more than I told you would be here. I really appreciate it, and I want to give both of you some chance to do some closing thoughts. And Dr. Lipson, let's go with you. Closing thoughts for people listening about Stephen Paddock and, in general, mental illness, guns, and criminal evaluation.
Well, the biggest takeaway, I think, is that we have to pay attention. And we're going to keep refining our awareness of what to look for. We already know a lot of things to look for. We talked about the guns being unkept. We talked about the lack of social connection. And it isn't any one of these in particular. It's the amount of something. And when there's too much of something, too much of guns, too much of isolation, too much anger, too much of a lack of hygiene and taking care of themselves, that's a sound and a sign that someone's deteriorating. And similar to Donna, I am looking forward to the toxicology reports. I'm looking forward to learning as much as we can from these instances to basically fine-tune the skills we need to deter these things from happening rather than have to be on the air and discussing them.
That's true. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Glenn Lipson. I'm just babbling here because I'm so fascinated with what you've been saying. Dr. Glenn Lipson, and I believe your website is it drglennlipson.com or is it glennlipson.com?
Yeah. Oh, I don't remember, but the one way is makingrightchoices.com. I know that exists.
Mm-hmm.
That's my preventing sexual misconduct in schools and preventing
teen
suicide.
Okay, and we could do a whole show on that, too. Yeah, definitely.
And you should, because that's also something that is just proliferating at a horrible degree. And anyway, can I just make a final thought? Here in Los Angeles, in California, Pacific time, it's 6:15, and at 7 o'clock, 60 Minutes is going to have the first four responders into Paddock's room, giving interviews, their first ever interviews. That'll be worth watching if it's already aired in your area or you listen to this later, try to see it on demand. I think that'll be worth listening to, watching. And just be safe. Be careful. Don't have children with somebody who's a nut.
There you go. That's
really
the biggest thing you
can do. Do whatever you can, just like a smart gambler. Put the odds in your favor. Don't be passive in our lives. Don't be a passive gambler like he was, just with a video game and slot machines where there's no smarts going into it, no strategy. Have strategy in your personal life. You may be saving your life and your children's life and many other people's lives. Drop a dime. Get yourself safe. Drop a dime.
There you go. Donna Kaufman, Dr. Glenn Lipson, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us tonight. It's been absolutely fascinating. And Dr. Lipson, I am going to have you on to discuss the problem with sexual contact between students and teachers. We'll have you on really soon to discuss that, okay?
I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both so much. Take care now.
Thank you, Tricia.
Bye-bye.
There's nobody online who does more for victims and families in need and missing persons than Tricia Griffith and WebSleuths.com and ForumsForJustice.org. You're doing a massive public service, and I'm grateful every day to what you've established and continue to run.
Wow, thank you, Donna. Thank you. That's very kind. All the wonderful people at WebSleuths and the moderators, it's definitely a big effort on everybody's part. So, Donna, that was very nice. Thank you. Now we'll
The A-team.
The A-team, there you go. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's go to Miss Bessie. Are you there?
I am here. Wow.
I know. That was amazing. I want to have Dr. Lipson on again to talk about the problem between teachers and kids having sex. Because let me tell you, when I was growing up, I started to say that, and then I realized it was really boring, and they were saying something much more interesting. But when I was growing up, I went to Brighton High School, and I knew students, girls having affairs with male teachers. Everybody knew it. And they, you know, did it for years. Now, as far as how far the affair went or whatever, I don't know. And the teachers in question have now passed away, at least the ones I know of. But, it wasn't a big deal. Let me put it to you that way, which is just disgusting when you think about it, because it should be a big deal. And I am so glad that Dr. Lipson is going to discuss this with us later, because I think it's very important for, if you have a girl or a boy in high school, doesn't matter. It's just equally as life-destroying.
Oh,
yeah. It really can be. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get off track there. But anyway, Bessie, what did you think of our guests tonight?
I just thought they were amazing. I learned things about the case that I didn't know, and I've been reading about it. But I am interested in the shooting of the fuel tanks at the Janet Airport. maybe that was an accident, but it's certainly something to read more about. And I liked Dr. Lipson's comments about situational awareness. I have friends who think I'm crazy because wherever I go, especially anywhere crowded or even in restaurants, I do like to sit with my back towards the wall or where I can scope out the room. Or anytime I go any place crowded, I always scope out the exits and kind of have a little plan in my head about how I could get out quickly or duck for cover or what are the more vulnerable spots. And I have friends and family that think I'm kind of cuckoo, but validated it for me, but that's not crazy.
Good.
I think everybody should do that.
And it is a sign of the times, and it's just one of the bad things we have to put up with in the world that we live in today. And I'd like to apologize if I sounded like I was drunk. I wasn't. I have tried to drink, and I can't. I've tried to become an alcoholic. It's done me no good. But I've had a bit of a reaction to some medicine that I took in my mouth, and it's fine. It's just my tongue is really swollen. So I've been trying to enunciate, and it has sometimes turned into just complete blather. Not my normal blather. This is worse than my normal blather. So, thank you for bearing with me.
It wasn't obvious at all.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I pointed it out, so now everybody will know. Okay, Bessie, next week we're going to have Aphrodite Jones on. And Aphrodite's got some very interesting things to discuss with us, and I'll be writing more about that on Web Sleuths. It's really a show you don't want to miss. So, Bessie, I know I can count on you, 8 o'clock Eastern on Web Sleuths Radio. We'll see you next week. Take care, Bessie. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.